Other Books by Gadfly Press. By Michael Sheridan. The Murder of Sophie. How I Hunted and Haunted the West Cork Killer. By Steve Wraith. The Craze, Final Years. My Time with London's Most Iconic Gangsters. By Natalie Welsh. Escape from Venezuela's Deadliest Prison. By Sean Atwood. English Sean Trilogy. Party Time, Hard Time, Prison Time. War on Drugs series. Pablo Escobar, Beyond Narcos. American Maid, Who Killed Barry Seal? Pablo Escobar or George H.W. Bush? The Cali Cartel, Beyond Narcos. Clinton, Bush and CIA Conspiracies. From the Boys on the Tracks to Jeffrey Epstein. Unmaking a Murderer. The Framing of Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey. The Mafia Philosopher. Two Tonys. Life Lessons. Pablo Escobar's Story. 4-book series. By Michael Sheridan. The Murder of Sophie. How I Hunted and Haunted the West Cork Killer. Just before Christmas, 1996, a beautiful French woman, the wife of a movie mogul, was brutally murdered outside of her holiday home in a remote region of West Cork, Ireland. The crime was reported by a local journalist, Ian Bailey, who was at the forefront of the case until he became the prime murder suspect. Arrested twice, he was released without charge. This was the start of a saga lasting decades with twists and turns and a battle for justice in two countries, which culminated in the 2019 conviction of Bailey, in his absence, by the French criminal court in Paris. But it was up to the Irish courts to decide whether he would be extradited to serve a 25-year prison sentence. With the unrivalled cooperation of major investigation sources and the backing of the victim's family, the author unravels the shocking facts of a unique murder case. By Steve Wraith. The Craze, Final Years. My Time with London's Most Iconic Gangsters. Britain's most notorious twins, Ron and Reg Cray, ascended the underworld to become the most feared and legendary gangsters in London. Their escalating mayhem culminated in murder, for which they received life sentences in 1969. While incarcerated, they received letters from a schoolboy from Tyneside, Steve Wraith, who was mesmerised by their story. Eventually, Steve visited them in prison, and a friendship formed. The twins hired Steve as an unofficial advisor, which brought him into contact with other members of their crime family. At Ron's funeral, Steve was Charlie Cray's right-hand man. Steve documents Ron's time in Broadmoor, a high-security psychiatric hospital, where he was battling insanity and heavily medicated. Steve details visiting Reg, who served almost 30 years in a variety of prisons, where the gangster was treated with the utmost respect by the staff and the inmates. By Natalie Welsh. Escape from Venezuela's Deadliest Prison. After getting arrested at a Venezuelan airport with a suitcase of cocaine, Natalie was clueless about the danger she was facing. Sentenced to 10 years, she arrived at a prison with armed men on the roof, whom she mistakenly believed were the guards, only to find out they were homicidal gang members. Immediately, she was plunged into a world of unimaginable horror and escalating violence, where murder, rape, and all-out gang warfare were carried out with the complicity of corrupt guards. Male prisoners often entered the females' housing area, bringing gunfire with them and leaving corpses behind. After 4.5 years, Natalie risked everything to escape and flee through Colombia with the help of a guard who had fallen deeply in love with her. By Sean Atwood. Pablo Escobar, Beyond Narcos. War on Drugs Series, Book 1. The mind-blowing true story of Pablo Escobar and the Medellin cartel beyond their portrayal on Netflix. Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar was a devoted family man and a psychopathic killer. A terrible enemy, yet a wonderful friend. While donating millions to the poor, he bombed and tortured his enemies. Some had their eyeballs removed with hot spoons. Through ruthless cunning and America's insatiable appetite for cocaine, he became a multi-billionaire who lived in a $100 million house with its own zoo. Pablo Escobar, Beyond Narcos, demolishes the standard good versus evil telling of his story. The authorities were not hunting Pablo down to stop his cocaine business. They were taking over it. American Made. Who Killed Barry Seal? Pablo Escobar or George H.W. Bush? War on Drugs Series, Book 2. Set in a world where crime and government coexist, American Made is the jaw-dropping true story of CIA pilot Barry Seal that the Hollywood movie starring Tom Cruise is afraid to tell. Barry Seal flew cocaine and weapons worth billions of dollars into and out of America in the 1980s. After he became a government informant, Pablo Escobar's Medellin cartel offered $1 million for him alive and $500,000 dead. But his real trouble began after he threatened to expose the dirty dealings of George H.W. Bush. American Made rips the roof off Bush and Clinton's complicity in cocaine trafficking in Mena, Arkansas. A conspiracy of the grandest magnitude, Congressman Bill Alexander, on the Mena affair. The Cali Cartel, Beyond Narcos, War on Drugs Series, Book 3. An electrifying account of the Cali Cartel beyond its portrayal on Netflix. From the ashes of Pablo Escobar's empire rose an even bigger and more malevolent cartel. A new breed of sophisticated mobsters became the kings of cocaine. Their leader was Gilberto Rodriguez Orejuela, known as the chess player, due to his foresight and calculated cunning. Gilberto and his terrifying brother, Miguel, ran a multi-billion dollar drug empire like a corporation. They employed a politically astute brand of thuggery and spent $10 million to put a president in power. Although the godfathers from Cali preferred bribery over violence, their many loyal torturers and hitmen were never idle. Clinton, Bush, and CIA conspiracies. From the Boys on the Tracks to Jeffrey Epstein. War on Drugs Series, Book 4. In the 1980s, George H.W. Bush imported cocaine to finance an illegal war in Nicaragua. Governor Bill Clinton's Arkansas State Police provided security for the drug drops. For assisting the CIA, the Clinton crime family was awarded the White House. The hashtag Clinton body count continues to this day, with the deceased including Jeffrey Epstein. This book features harrowing true stories that reveal the insanity of the drug war. A mother receives the worst news about her son. A journalist gets a tip that endangers his life. An unemployed man becomes California's biggest crack dealer. A DEA agent in Mexico is sacrificed for going after the big players. The lives of Linda Ives, Gary Webb, Freeway Rick Ross, and Kiki Camarena are shattered by brutal experiences. Not all of them will survive. Pablo Escobar's Story, 4-book series. Finally, the definitive book about Escobar, original and up-to-date. Unilad. The most comprehensive account ever written. True Geordie. Pablo Escobar was a mama's boy who cherished his family and sang in the shower. Yet he bombed a passenger plane and formed a death squad that used genital electrocution. Most Escobar biographies only provide a few pieces of the puzzle, but this action-packed 1,000-page book reveals everything about the King of Cocaine. Mostly translated from Spanish, Part 1 contains stories untold in the English-speaking world, including the tragic death of his youngest brother, Fernando, the fate of his pregnant mistress, the shocking details of his affair with a TV celebrity, the presidential candidate who encouraged him to eliminate their rivals. The Mafia Philosopher, a fast-paced true crime memoir with all the action of Goodfellas, Unilad, Sopranos versus Sons of Anarchy with an Alaskan snow backdrop, True Geordie podcast. Breaking Bones, Burying Bodies, and Planting Bombs became second nature to two Tonys while working for the Bonanno crime family, whose exploits inspired The Godfather. After a dispute with an outlaw motorcycle club, two Tonys left a trail of corpses from Arizona to Alaska. On the run, he was pursued by bikers and a neo-Nazi gang, bloodthirsty for revenge, while a homicide detective launched a nationwide manhunt. As the mist from his smoking gun fades, readers are left with an unexpected portrait of a stoic philosopher with a wealth of charm, a glorious turn of phrase, and a fanatical devotion to his daughter. Party Time. An action-packed roller coaster account of a life spiraling out of control, featuring wild women, gangsters, and a mountain of drugs. Sean Atwood arrived in Phoenix, Arizona, a penniless business graduate from a small industrial town in England. Within a decade, he became a stock market millionaire, but he was leading a double life. After taking his first ecstasy pill at a rave in Manchester as a shy student, Sean became intoxicated by the party lifestyle that would change his fortune. Years later, in the Arizona desert, he became submerged in a criminal underworld, throwing parties for thousands of ravers and running an ecstasy ring in competition with the mafia mass murderer, Sammy the Bull Gravano. As greed and excess tore through his life, Sean had eye-watering encounters with mafia hitmen and crystal meth addicts, enjoyed extravagant debauchery with superstar DJs and glitter girls, and ingested enough drugs to kill a herd of elephants. This is his story. Hard Time makes the Shawshank Redemption look like a holiday camp. News of the World. After a SWAT team smashed down stock market millionaire Sean Atwood's door, he found himself inside Arizona's deadliest jail and locked into a brutal struggle for survival. Sean's hope of living the American dream turned into a nightmare of violence and chaos when he had a run-in with Sammy the Bull Gravano, an Italian mafia mass murderer. In jail, Sean was forced to endure cockroaches crawling in his ears at night, dead rats in the food, and the sound of skulls being cracked against toilets. He meticulously documented the conditions and smuggled out his message. Join Sean on a harrowing voyage into the darkest recesses of human existence. Hard Time provides a revealing glimpse into the tragedy, brutality, dark comedy, and eccentricity of prison life. Featured worldwide on National Geographic channels, Locked Up, Banged Up Abroad, Raving Arizona. Prison Time. Sentenced to 9.5 years in Arizona's state prison for distributing ecstasy, Sean finds himself living among gang members, sexual predators, and drug-crazed psychopaths. After being attacked by a Californian biker in for stabbing a girlfriend, Sean writes about the prisoners who befriend, protect, and inspire him. They include T-Bone, a massive African-American ex-Marine, who risks his life saving vulnerable inmates from rape, and Two Tonys, an old-school mafia murderer who left the corpses of his rivals from Arizona to Alaska. They teach Sean how to turn incarceration to his advantage and to learn from his mistakes. Sean is no stranger to love and lust in the heterosexual world, but the tables are turned on him inside. Sexual advances come at him from all directions, some cleverly disguised, others more sinister, making Sean question his sexual identity. Resigned to living alongside violent, mentally ill and drug-addicted inmates, Sean immerses himself in psychology and philosophy to try to make sense of his past behaviour and begins applying what he learns as he adapts to prison life. Encouraged by two Tonys to explore fiction as well, Sean reads over 1,000 books which, with support from a brilliant psychotherapist, Dr. Owen, speed along his personal development. As his ability to deflect daily threats improves, Sean begins to look forward to his release with optimism and a new love waiting for him. Yet the words of Aristotle from one of Sean's books will prove prophetic. We cannot learn without pain. Unmaking a Murderer. The framing of Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey. Innocent people do go to jail. Sometimes mistakes are made. But even more terrifying is when the authorities conspire to frame them. That's what happened to Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey, who were convicted of murder and are serving life sentences. Unmaking a Murderer is an explosive book which uncovers the illegal, devious, and covert tactics used by Wisconsin officials, including concealing other suspects, paying expert witnesses to lie, planting evidence, jury tampering. The art of framing innocent people has been in practice for centuries and will continue until the perpetrators are held accountable. Turning conventional assumptions and beliefs in the justice system upside down, Unmaking a Murderer takes you on that journey. Hard Time by Sean Atwood. Chapter 1. Sleep-deprived and scanning for danger, I enter a dark cell on the second floor of the maximum security Madison Street Jail in Phoenix, Arizona, where guards and gang members are murdering prisoners. Behind me, the metal door slams heavily. Light slants into the cell through oblong gaps in the door, illuminating a prisoner cocooned in a white sheet, snoring lightly on the top bunk about two-thirds of the way up the back wall. Relieved there is no immediate threat, I place my mattress on the grimy floor. Desperate to rest, I notice movement on the cement block walls. Am I hallucinating? I blink several times. The walls appear to ripple. Stepping closer, I see the walls are alive with insects. I flinch. So many are swarming, I wonder if there are a colony of ants on the move. To get a better look, I put my eyes right up to them. They are mostly the size of almonds and have antennae. American cockroaches. I've seen them in the holding cells downstairs in smaller numbers, but nothing like this. A chill spread over my body. I back away. Something alive falls from the ceiling and bounces off the base of my neck. I jump. With my night vision improving, I spot cockroaches weaving in and out of the base of the fluorescent strip light. Every so often one drops onto the concrete and resumes crawling. Examining the bottom bunk, I realise why my cellmate is sleeping at a higher elevation. Cockroaches are pouring from gaps in the decrepit wall at the level of my bunk. The area is thick with them. Placing my mattress on the bottom bunk scatters them. I walk towards the toilet, crunching a few under my shower sandals. I urinate and grab the toilet roll. A cockroach darts from the centre of the roll onto my hand, tickling my fingers. My arm jerks as if it has a mind of its own, losing the cockroach and the toilet roll. Using a towel, I wipe the bulk of them off the bottom bunk, stopping only to shake the odd one off my hand. I unroll my mattress. They begin to regroup and inhabit my mattress. My adrenaline is pumping so much, I lose my fatigue. Nauseated, I sit on a tiny metal stool bolted to the wall. How will I sleep? How's my cellmate sleeping through the infestation and my arrival? Copying his technique, I cocoon myself in a sheet and lie down, crushing more cockroaches. The only way they can access me now is through the breathing hole I've left in the sheet by the lower half of my face. Inhaling their strange musty odour, I close my eyes. I can't sleep. I feel them crawling on the sheet around my feet. Am I imagining things? Frightened of them infiltrating my breathing hole, I keep opening my eyes. Cramps cause me to rotate onto my other side. Facing the wall, I am repulsed by so many of them just inches away. I return to my original side. The sheet traps the heat of the Sonoran Desert to my body, soaking me in sweat. Sweat tickles my body, tricking my mind into thinking the cockroaches are infiltrating and crawling on me. The trapped heat aggravates my bleeding skin infections and bed sores. I want to scratch myself, but I know better. The outer layers of my skin have turned soggy from sweating constantly in this concrete oven. Squirming on the bunk fails to stop the relentless itchiness of my skin. Eventually, I scratch myself. Clumps of moist skin detach under my nails. Every now and then I become so uncomfortable, I must open my cocoon to waft the heat out, which allows the cockroaches in. It takes hours to drift to sleep. I only manage a few hours. I awake stuck to the soaked sheet, disgusted by the cockroach carcasses compressed against the mattress. The cockroaches plague my new home until dawn appears at the dots in the metal grid over a begrimed strip of 4-inch thick, bulletproof glass at the top of the back wall, the cell's only source of outdoor light. They disappear into the cracks in the walls, like vampire mist retreating from sunlight. But not all of them. There were so many of them on the night shift that even their vastly reduced number is too many to dispose of. And they act like they know it. They roam around my feet with attitude, as if to make it clear that I'm trespassing on their turf. My next set of challenges will arise not from the insect world, but from my neighbours. I'm the new arrival, subject to scrutiny about my charges, just like when I'd run into the Aryan Brotherhood prison gang on my first day at the medium security Towers jail a year ago. I wish my cellmate would wake up, brief me on the mood of the locals, and introduce me to the head of the white gang. No such luck. Chow is announced over a speaker system, in a crackly, robotic voice, but he doesn't stir. I emerge into the day room for breakfast. Prisoners in black and white V-striped uniforms gather under the metal grid stairs and tip dead cockroaches into a trash bin from plastic peanut butter containers they'd set as traps during the night. All eyes are on me in the chow line. Watching who sits where, I hold my head up, put on a solid stare, and pretend to be as at home in this environment as the cockroaches. It's all an act. I'm lonely and afraid. I loathe having to explain myself to the head of the white race, who I assume is the toughest murderer. I've been in jail long enough to know that taking my breakfast to my cell will imply that I have something to hide. The gang punishes criminals with certain charges. The most serious are sex offenders who are KOS, kill on sight. Other charges are punishable by SOS, smash on sight, such as drive-by shootings, because women and kids sometimes get killed. It's called convict justice. Gang members are constantly looking for people to beat up, because that's how they earn their reputations and tattoos. The most serious acts of violence earn the highest ranking tattoos. To be a full gang member requires murder. I've observed the body language and techniques inmates trying to integrate employ. An inmate with a spring in his step and an air of confidence is likely to be accepted. A person who avoids eye contact and fails to introduce himself to the gang is likely to be preyed on. Some of the failed attempts I saw ended up with heads getting cracked against toilets, a sound I've grown familiar with. I've seen prisoners being extracted on stretchers who looked dead. One had yellow fluid leaking from his head. The constant violence gives me nightmares. but the reality is that I put myself in here, so I force myself to accept it as a part of my punishment. It's time to apply my knowledge. With a self-assured stride, I take my breakfast bag to the table of white inmates covered in neo-Nazi tattoos, allowing them to question me. "Mind if I sit with you guys?" I ask, glad exhaustion has deepened my voice. "These seats are taken, but you can stand at the corner of the table." The man who answered is probably the head of the gang. I size him up. Cropped brown hair, a dangerous glint in Nordic blue eyes, tiny pupils that suggest he's on heroin, weightlifter-type veins bulging from a sturdy neck, political ink on arms crisscrossed with scars. About the same age as me, 33. "Thanks, I'm Sean from England. I volunteer my origin to show I'm different from them, but not in a way that might get me smashed. I'm Bullet, the head of the Whites." He offers me his fist to bump. "Where you're all in from, Wood?" Addressing me as Wood is a good sign. It's what white gang members on a friendly basis call each other. Towers Jail. They increased my bond and reclassified me to maximum security. "What's your bond at?" "I've got two $750,000 bonds," I say in a monotone. This is no place to brag about bonds. "How many people you killed, brother?" His eyes drill into mine, checking whether my body language supports my story. My body language so far is spot on. "None. I threw rave parties. They got us talking about drugs on wiretaps." Discussing drugs on the phone does not warrant a $1.5 million bond. I know, and beat him to his next question. "Here's my charges." I show him my charge sheet, which includes conspiracy and leading a crime syndicate, both from running an ecstasy ring. Bullet snatches the paper and scrutinizes it. Attempting to preempt his verdict, the other whites study his face. On edge, I wait for him to respond. Whatever he says next will determine whether I'll be accepted or victimized. "Are you some kind of jailhouse attorney?" Bullet asks. "I want someone to read through my case paperwork." During our few minutes of conversation, Bullet has seen through my act and concluded that I am educated, a possible resource to him. I appreciate that he'll accept me if I take the time to read his case. I'm no jailhouse attorney, but I'll look through it and help you however I can. "Good. I'll stop by your cell later on, Wood." After breakfast, I seal as many of the cracks in the walls as I can with toothpaste. The cell smells minty, but the cockroaches still find their way in. Their day shift appears to be collecting information on the brown paper bags under my bunk, containing a few items of food that I purchased from the commissary, bags that I tied off with rubber bands in the hope of keeping the cockroaches out. Relentlessly, the cockroaches explore the bags for entry points, pausing over and probing the most worn and vulnerable regions. Will the nightly swarm eat right through the paper? I read all morning, wondering whether my cellmate has died in his cocoon, his occasional breathing sounds reassuring me. Bullet stops by late afternoon and drops his case paperwork off. He's been charged with Class 3 felonies and less, not serious crimes, but is facing a double-digit sentence because of his prior convictions and security threat group status in the prison system. The proposed sentencing range seems disproportionate. I'll advise him to reject the plea bargain, on the assumption he already knows to do so, but is just seeking the comfort of a second opinion, like many unsentenced inmates. When he returns for his paperwork, our conversation disturbs my cellmate. The cocoon shuffles, so we go upstairs to his cell. I tell Bullet what I think. He is excitable, a different man from earlier, his pupils almost non-existent. "This case ain't shit, but my prosecutor knows I done other shit, all kinds of heavy shit, but can't prove it. I'd do anything to get that sorry bitch off my fucking ass. She's asking for something bad to happen to her. Man, if I ever get bonded out, I'm gonna chop that bitch into pieces, Kill her slowly, though. Like to work her over with a blowtorch. Such talk can get us both charged with conspiring to murder a prosecutor, so I try to steer him elsewhere. It's crazy how they can catch you doing one thing, yet try to sentence you for all of the things they think you've ever done. Done plenty. Shot some dude in the stomach once. Rolled him up in a blanket and threw him in a dumpster. Discussing past murders is as unsettling as future ones. So what's all your tattoos mean, Bullet? Like that eagle on your chest. Why you want to know? Bullet's eyes probe mine. My eyes hold their ground. Just curious. It's a warbird. The AB patch. AB patch? What the Aryan Brotherhood gives you when you've put enough work in. How long does it take to earn a patch? Depends how quickly you put your work in. You have to earn your lightning bolts first. Why you got red and black lightning bolts? You get SS bolts for beating someone down, or for being an enforcer for the family. Red lightning bolts for killing someone. I was sent down as a youngster. They gave me steel, and told me who to handle, and I handled it. You don't ask questions. You just get blood on your steel. Dudes who get these tats without putting work in are told to cover them up or leave the yard. What if they refuse? They're held down and we carve the ink off them. Imagining them carving a chunk of flesh to remove a tattoo, I cringe. He's really enjoying telling me this now. His volatile nature is clear and frightening. He's accepted me too much. He's trying to impress me before making demands. At night, I'm unable to sleep. Cocooned in heat, surrounded by cockroaches, I hear the swamp cooler vent, a metal grid at the top of a wall, hissing out tepid air. Giving up on sleep, I put my earphones on and tune into National Public Radio. Listening to a Vivaldi violin concerto, I close my eyes and press my tailbone down to straighten my back, as if I'm doing a yogic relaxation. The playful allegro thrills me, lifting my spirits, but the wistful adagio provokes sad emotions and tears. I open my eyes and gaze into the gloom. Due to lack of sleep, I start hallucinating and hearing voices over the music, whispering threats. I'm at breaking point. Although I have accepted that I committed crimes and deserve to be punished, no one should have to live like this. I'm furious at myself for making the series of reckless decisions that put me in here, and for losing absolutely everything. As violins crescendo in my ears, I remember what my life used to be like. Prison Time by Sean Atwood. Chapter 1. I've got a padlock and a sock. I can smash your brains in while you're asleep. I can kill you whenever I want. My new cellmate sizes me up, with no trace of human feeling in his eyes. Muscular and pot-bellied, he's caked in prison ink, including 6 snakes on his skull, slithering side by side. The top of his right ear is missing, in a semicircle. The waves of fear are overwhelming. After being in transportation all day, I can feel my bladder hurting. I'm not looking to cause any trouble. I'm the quietest cellmate you'll ever have. All I do is read and write. Scowling, he shakes his head. Why have they put a fish in with me? He swaggers close enough for me to smell his cigarette breath. Us convicts don't get along with fresh fish. Should I ask to move, then? I say, hoping he'll agree if he hates new prisoners so much. No. They'll think I threatened you. In the 8x12 feet slab of space, I swerve around him and place my property box on the top bunk. He pushes me aside and grabs the box. You just put that on my artwork. I ought to fucking smash you, fish. Sorry, I didn't see it. You need to be more aware of your fucking surroundings. What are you in for anyway, fish? I explain my charges. Ecstasy dealing and how I spent 26 months fighting my case. How come the cops were so hardcore after you? He asks, squinting. It was a big case, a multi-million-dollar investigation. They raided over 100 people and didn't find any drugs. They were pretty pissed off. I'd stopped dealing by the time they caught up with me, but I'd done plenty over the years, so I accept my punishment. Throwing raves, he says, staring at the ceiling, as if remembering something. Were you partying with underage girls? He asks, his voice slow, coaxing. Being called a sex offender is the worst insult in prison. Into my third year of incarceration, I'm conditioned to react. What are you trying to say? I yell angrily, brow clenched. Were you fucking underage girls? Flexing his body, he shakes both fists as if to punch me. Hey, I'm no child molester, and I prefer you didn't say shit like that. My buddy next door is doing 25 to life for murdering a child molester. How do I know ecstasy dealing ain't your cover story? He inhales loudly, nostrils flaring. You want to see my fucking paperwork? A stocky prisoner walks in. Short hair, dark eyes, powerful neck. On one arm, a tattoo of a man in handcuffs above the word Omerta, the mafia code of silence towards law enforcement. What the fuck's going on in here, bud? Asked Junior Bull, the son of Sammy the Bull Gravano, the mafia mass murderer, who was my biggest competitor in the ecstasy market. Relieved to see a familiar face, I say, how are you doing? Shaking my hand, he says, in a New York Italian accent, I'm doing all right. I read that shit in the newspaper about you starting a blog in Sheriff Joe Arpaio's jail. The blog's been bringing media heat on the conditions. You know him? Bud asks. Yeah, from Towers Jail. He's a good dude. He's in for dealing ecstasy like me. It's a good job you said that, because I was about to smash his ass, Bud says. It's a good job Wildman ain't here, because you'd have got your ass thrown off the balcony, Junior Bull says. I laugh. The presence of my best friend, Wildman, was partly the reason I never took a beating at the county jail. But with Wildman in a different prison, I feel vulnerable. When Bud casts a death stare on me, my smile fades. What the fuck are you guys on about? Bud asks. Let's go talk downstairs. Junior Bull leads Bud out. I rush to a stainless steel sink toilet, bolted to a cement block wall by the front of the cell, unbutton my orange jumpsuit, and crane my neck to watch the upper tier walkway in case Bud returns. I bask in relief as my bladder deflates. After flushing, I take stock of my new home, grateful for the slight improvement in the conditions versus what I'd grown accustomed to in Sheriff Joe Arpaio's jail. No cockroaches, no bloodstains, a working swamp cooler. Something I have never seen in a cell before. Shelves. The steel table bolted to the wall is slightly larger too. But how will I concentrate on writing with Bud around? There's a mixture of smells in the room. Cleaning chemicals, aftershave, tobacco, a vinegar-like odour. The slit of a window at the back overlooks gravel in a no-man's land before the next building with gleaming curls of razor wire around its roof. From the doorway upstairs, I'm facing two stories of cells, overlooking a day room, with shower cubicles at the end of both tiers. At two white plastic circular tables, prisoners are playing dominoes, cards, chess, and Scrabble, some concentrating, others yelling obscenities, contributing to a brain-scraping din that I hope to block out by purchasing a Walkman. In a raised, box-shaped plexiglass control tower, two guards are monitoring the prisoners. Bud returns. My pulse jumps. Not wanting to feel like I'm stuck in a kennel with a rabid dog, I grab a notepad and pen and head for the day room. Focused on my body language, not wanting to signal any weakness, I'm striding along the upper tier, head and chest elevated, when two hands appear from a doorway and grab me. I drop the pad. The pen clinks against grid metal and tumbles to the day room as I'm pulled into a cell reeking of backside sweat and masturbation, a cheese-tinted funk. "I'm Booga. Let's fuck," says a squat man in urine-stained boxers, with white trash tattooed on his torso below a mobile home and an arm sleeved with the Virgin Mary. Shocked, I brace to flee or fight to preserve my anal virginity. I can't believe my eyes when he drops his boxers and waggles his penis. Dancing to music playing through a speaker he has rigged up, Booga smiles in a sexy way. "Come on," he says in a husky voice. "Drop your pants. Let's fuck." He pulls pornography faces. I question his sanity. He moves closer. "If I let you fart in my mouth, can I fart in yours?" "You can fuck off," I say, springing towards the doorway. He grabs me. We scuffle. Every time I make progress towards the doorway, he clings to my clothes, dragging me back in. When I feel his penis rub against my leg, my adrenaline kicks in so forcefully I experience a burst of strength and wriggle free. I bolt out as fast as my shower sandals will allow and snatch my pad. Looking over my shoulder, I see him stood calmly in the doorway, smiling. He points at me. "You have to walk past my door every day. We're going to get together. I'll lick your ass and you can fart in my mouth." Booga blows a kiss and disappears. I rush downstairs. With my back to a wall, I pause to steady my thoughts and breathing. In survival mode, I think, what's going to come at me next? In the hope of reducing my tension, I borrow a pen to do what helps me stay sane, writing. With the details fresh in my mind, I document my journey to the prison for my blog readers, keeping an eye out in case anyone else wants to test the new prisoner. The more I write, the more I fill with a sense of purpose. John's jail journal is a connection to the outside world that I cherish. Someone yells, "One time!" The din lowers. A door rumbles open. A guard does a security walk, his every move scrutinized by dozens of scornful eyes staring from cells. When he exits, the din resumes, and the prisoners return to injecting drugs to escape from reality, including the length of their sentences. This continues all day with 2 times, signifying 2 approaching guards, and 3 times 3, and so on. Every now and then, an announcement by a guard over the speakers briefly lowers the din. Before lockdown, I join the line for a shower, holding bars of soap and a towel that I aim to swing at the head of the next person to try me. With boisterous inmates a few feet away, yelling at the men in the showers to stop jerking off and hurry the fuck up, I get in a cubicle that reeks of bleach and mildew. With every nerve strained, I undress and rinse fast. At night, despite the desert heat, I cocoon myself in a blanket from head to toe and turn towards the wall, making my face more difficult to strike. I leave a hole for air, but the warm cement block inches from my mouth returns each exhalation to my face as if it's breathing on me, creating a feeling of suffocation. For hours, my heart drums so hard against the thin mattress, I feel as if I'm moving even though I'm still. I try to sleep, but my eyes keep springing open and my head turning towards the cell as I try to penetrate the darkness, searching for Bud swinging a padlock in a sock at my head.